telling him some messages to the churches, and then takes him from that earthly location to heavenly location. So the window opens, they go to heaven, shows him the throne room of God, who's standing there with all the 24 elders, or God sitting there on the throne. He's got a scroll in his hand, and then a lamb comes up who is slain and is worthy to take the scroll. And then the rest of the after five there, the rest of the book is essentially of him opening the scroll and essentially giving us the message of the scroll. So the very first thing is, on the scroll are seven seals, wax seals, you know, a king would typically have sealed up with a signet ring, so that they could not, only the one, you know, who was addressed to could open it. But there are seven of them, and so the first four pop out, the four horsemen of the apocalypse that are referred to. And then, you know, the last three, we get, you know, successively more things begin to happen until really this, but it's all preparing for war, right? Preparation for battle. And then the last seal is popped, and it out come seven angels with seven trumpets. And if you're thinking about an angel with a trumpet, really should be more picturing an army. A trumpeter for the army. So, because each trumpet is going to blow and give the army's command for somebody to advance in some way. And that's essentially, again, what happens with each of the four trumpets. And so the four trumpets start off again a little bit like the four seals, where we get really the four horsemen of the apocalypse coming out again and beginning to do battle, and they begin to, you know, destroy certain things, and then we're told that we get the three last trumpets are going to be three woes, and these three woes, just kind of remind ourselves a little bit, you know, the first woe, like the fifth trumpet was in verse 9, in chapter 9 you get the first of the first and the last three trumpeter angels bringing a woe upon the earth. And so, you know, a star falls from heaven, given the key to the bottomless pit, opens the bottomless pit, out comes the smoke, and out comes these terrible horse-like scorpion. I think of scorpions, but because they have like scorpion tails and stuff, so this horse, you know, like scorpion thing.
Scorpions with horse faces, right?
Yeah, or a horse with a scorpion tail. They have these strange kind of beings coming, and they're basically coming to. They're gonna seek death. They won't be able to find it. They were allowed to basically torment for 5 months, but not kill them. And so we're getting essentially kind of just tormenting the people. And then the first woe is passed, and the second woe happens. So the sixth trumpet. So in that seventh seal, it opens seven trumpets, and in that sixth trumpet, we get a voice from the altar of God talking, release the four angels who are bound at the Euphrates. They had been held back, if you remember right, to mark all the people that were part of, you know, God's of Israel, and that they wouldn't be harmed. And so they're released to kill a third of mankind. Comes out after, you know, that weren't killed. He then sees an angel come down with a little scroll open in his hand. So this scroll is not a sealed one. This one's an open one with a message, and he's telling, you know, this Well, this angel comes down, sits his right foot on the sea, left foot on the land, and he calls out like a lion roaring, and seven thunders sound. And then when they sounded, I was about to write, and then the angel said, no, don't do that. Basically, you're not gonna pass on this message. But in this, we're still in the second woe, the sixth trumpet, where we get the two witnesses, okay? And the two witnesses really remind us of the Old Testament two witnesses of the priesthood and the kings of Israel that Zechariah talks about. And you know, they are for 42 months or 3.5 years, they are given, they're actively working, right? And they have these olive trees and two lampstands that are filling them. And they are consuming any of the foes for a little while, okay? But then it says, so they basically then are killed and resurrected, essentially. So the peoples of the earth gather around and they conquer, and then they kind of drag their dead bodies through the streets in verse 8 of chapter 11. And then very specifically mentions this is a reference to Jerusalem. So we have in this sixth trumpet, in the second woe, the destruction of Jerusalem, and the people, the nations, rejoicing. But that only, again, lasts for 3.5 days. So this 3.5 comes out regularly here. And then it's resurrected. And we talked about this. It's kind of an important little just moment, because it really is most likely the imagery of gods of Israel looking like it disappeared, but then is resurrected. But it's not resurrected as the set 12 tribes of Israel. It's resurrected as those who follow the Christ, the Lord, okay? And that's going to be what happens kind of throughout. And so we're going to have this woman show up here. Instead of two witnesses, we're going to see Israel become a woman, which is also a common imagery in the Old Testament as well. So the second woe has passed when they're all... After God had, after the resurrection of Israel, and the killing, he talks about, and so that we're coming to the third row. I think we've already started. I can't remember where in the third row we had kind of left off. But so the seventh angel blows his trumpet, Basically, we're told the kingdom of the world has become the kingdom of our Lord and of his Christ, and he shall reign forever and ever. And I want you to think about it this way. Before two nations go to war, what typically happens to start it? And just think about the American Revolution for a moment. So, in basically the New England area of the United States, you had all these colonies of England, okay? But the colonies didn't go to war with England. Who went to war with England?
The rebels, right?
The United States of America. Yeah. So they declared themselves a nation and then went to war. Because that's actually kind of how they happen, right? Somebody declares, we're not this anymore. And so, in one sense, with this seventh angel starting off with, the Lord Christ is the king of all the world. Well, what does that say to Rome? What does that say to the nations of this earth? You are not in charge. I am in charge. Now, does it look like that yet? At the beginning of that statement, that's not usually what happens. And so there becomes this battle over this exact statement that he has to rule. Now, this goes all the way back to Daniel. When he prophesied about that statue, those four kingdoms that would all rule over God's people. Because that's essentially what it was about, okay? Babylon, Persia, Greece, and Rome would all rule God's people. But then a rock would come out of the mountain and would destroy those empires. And they would no longer rule God's people. So what we are really, what we're given in Revelation in many ways is a description of the conclusion of that. And so as I pointed out to you a couple weeks ago, in Daniel as well, there's a vision of 70 weeks that, which archangel comes in? Gabriel? Gabriel, what it tells him? Vision? Anyway, vision of 70 weeks. So we have these 70 weeks, and in the last week, halfway through the last week, so 3.5 days of the last week, Jerusalem falls. It's destroyed by the destroyer. But at the end of the last week, he destroys the destroyer. The one he had used to bring judgment upon Jerusalem, God himself destroys. Okay? And so we're seeing, and in this whole vision, remember, we went back to Jesus' ascension into heaven, to Jerusalem, to the destruction of Jerusalem, and now the Lord himself, Christ, rising up to be the Lord of lords and King of kings. And then what is the world going to do? What is Rome going to do to that? Well, they fought Jerusalem, right? They destroyed Jerusalem. So what did they start doing some years later when they realized, wait a second, we now have another strain of this Israel called Christianity that has now become a problem. And they began to fight it. But unlike Jerusalem, which took up arms and got themselves in a fortified city, the Christians never took up arms. They simply kept going. They kept doing. They kept living. And Israel kept fighting. Rome kept fighting. And they, all the way until they essentially give up in the 4th century. And so, what we're seeing, and that's kind of what's happening here at the beginning of the 7th trumpet. The shift has been made from the destruction of Jerusalem, God's people seem like they're gone, but then they're resurrected. They're resurrected in the church, and Jesus is now Lord of lords and King of kings, right? And he's going to reign forever and ever, and the 24 elders who sit on their thrones before God fell on their faces and worship God. So now we're back to the throne room image for a second. And then they're saying, and probably we could probably picture them singing this, and they go on and they sing all of that. And in fact, the very last line is for destroying, part of what they're doing is destroying the destroyers of the earth. Because that's what God is doing. From kind of this point on, we're going to get the war between now God and the those who think they are the King of kings and rulers of rulers. Because that's actually how Rome saw themselves. That's actually how Babylon saw themselves. That's how Persia saw themselves. Greece didn't have quite the singular empire as long. But they were a lot more fragmented. But they saw themselves. That was the concept of an empire. An empire, what made it different from a nation, a big nation, was the empire was a king of kings. So you had all these kings in all these locations, but the empire, the emperor got to rule kings. And essentially what Christianity comes along and says, you are no longer the king of kings. Jesus is the king of kings. Okay. And they will fight that. And then we have know, in verse 11, you know, it's like thunder and lightning is all happening there in the throne room. And then it says a great sign appeared in heaven, and we have the woman and the dragon. And so a woman clothed with the sun, moon under her feet, and on her head a crown of 12 stars. She was pregnant, crying out in birth pains, in agony of giving birth. And this concept, by the way, is also an Old Testament imagery. In fact, Jesus himself talks about this idea of birth pangs, that Israel had to give birth to something. Israel was not just something that was chosen to be blessed. Israel was a vessel to give birth to the Son. Okay. And so the dragon is going to basically go to war now with the woman. And so we have the great red dragon. It's got all these seven heads, 10 horns, seven diadems. So you see the difference between, you can also translate diadems crown, but it's a different kind of crown. That's the king's crown. The crown that the woman has is the Stephanos. It's the laurel wreath crown that they were given to the victors in the Olympic Games. His tail swept down a third of the stars and cast them to earth. The dragon stood before the woman who's about to give birth so that when she bore her child, he might devour it. Now notice, we're kind of moving through time back and forth, right? If we're talking about this child not being born again, well, it's like, well, we kind of moved back in time, all essentially, in visions. So the dragon is trying to kill this child of this woman. And she gives birth to the male child, who is one who is to rule all nations with a rod of iron, but her child is caught up to God and to his throne. So now we're referring back to that, kind of which happened in chapter 5. And the woman fled into the wilderness, where she had a place prepared by God in which she is to be nourished for 1260 days, which is a reference to 3.5 years. So it's kind of like we destroyed Israel, but then Israel ran to the wilderness for a while before it began to come out again. And it says, now war arose in heaven, Michael and his angels fighting the dragon. Dragon and his angels fight back, and he's defeated. There was no longer any place for them in heaven. The great dragon was thrown down, that ancient serpent who is called the devil and Satan. We talked a little bit about somebody asked last week, Satan in heaven, it seems like a weird thing, but that's actually exactly where he is in Job, isn't he? And so him being thrown out of heaven is essentially symbolized here. So part of the battle is destroying the devil. But he's initially just, essentially given the earth as his place to rule, and he will, take it out on the earth. He's the deceiver of the whole world. He was thrown down to the earth. His angels were thrown down with him. And I heard a loud voice in heaven saying, now the salvation, the power, the kingdom of our God, and the authority of his Christ have come, for the accuser of our brothers has been thrown down, who accuses them day and night before our God. And that's really kind of exactly what's happening in Job, isn't it? Satan is there accusing people before God. And God has finally gone, you're out. You can't accuse them anymore because of the blood of the Lamb. The blood of the Lamb has now cleansed them. They're not guilty anymore. He's made them holy by paying the price for them. When all of those kind of biblical concepts come out. And he says, therefore rejoice, O heavens, and you who dwell in them. Woe to you, O earth and sea, for the devil has come down to you in great wrath, because he knows that his time is short. And so, the devil's going to fight back. And he's going to fight back with those who do his bidding. Not just those angels who follow him, but also really the worldly people who follow him. Because he is trying to get these kings and things to do wicked things. And so when the dragon saw that he'd been thrown down to the earth, he pursued the woman who had given birth to the male child. And the woman was given the two wings of the great eagle, so she might fly from the serpent into the wilderness to the place where she is to be nourished for a time, times and a half time. The serpent poured water. The serpent poured water like a river out of his mouth after the woman to sweep her away with the flood. But the earth came to help the woman, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed the river that the dragon had poured from his mouth. And the dragon became furious, and the woman went off to make war on the rest of her offspring, on those who keep the commandments of God and hold to the testimony of Jesus. There, you get that concept, right? Israel gives birth not only to the Son, but also to those who follow the Son. And now he's going to make war. Not going to make war with the woman who gave birth, Israel, because Israel is essentially gone, conceptually, right? And we're going to then make war on the other offspring, those who follow Jesus. And I saw, beast rising out of the sea, 10 horns, 7 heads, 10 diadems on its horns, and blasphemous names on its head. So this beast rising out of the sea, pretty similar to the great dragon, right? And so it says the beast I saw was like a leopard, feet like bears, mouth like a lion's mouth. To the dragon gave, and to it the dragon gave his power and his throne and great authority. One of its heads seemed to have a mortal wound, but its mortal wound was healed. The whole earth marveled as they followed the beast. They worshiped the dragon, for he had given his authority to the beast, and they worshiped the beast, saying, "Who is like the beast? Who can fight against it?" Which is, think about it, isn't that what people said about Rome? Who could fight Rome? In their time, they, and his, my historical readings, if I remember them accurately, is that Rome never really lost a battle. They didn't lose wars. They one of the things that happened to Rome in terms of its military might is that it eventually became where almost all of their soldiers were simply hired hands. They were slaves and or mercenaries. They were all hired because they didn't have a lot of Romans that fought anymore. But still, as they went out, they kind of crumble rather than that. They never really fall. So in that way, they actually fight each other because they split east and west. In the second century, there's already the second century AD, and a lot of people might not remember. From there all the way to Constantine in the fourth century finally puts an end to the split between east and west. Constantinople, kind of in Turkey, modern-day Turkey, rules the eastern portion of the Roman Empire, and the emperor in Rome rules essentially western Mediterranean. But it was split in the second century. It already had begun to fall in that way, to crumble. Anyway, the beast was given mouth, uttering haughty and blasphemous words. It was allowed to exercise authority for 42 months. It opened its mouth to utter blasphemies against God. Now, this goes back to that last week of the 70 weeks. Remember, halfway through that last week, Rome was destroyed. But then at the end of the week, the destroyer is destroyed. And so notice that that's saying the same thing, right? That halfway, Jerusalem's destroyed, but then it essentially rests for, half a week until the destroyer is destroyed. And that same imagery is being used here, especially with this 3.5 being used regularly. Anyway. So, did we cover any of this? Mm-hmm. We haven't covered this part.
I don't think so. I think we ended last week with the woman fleeing. Yeah.
Okay, at the end of 12.
Yeah. Yeah. So we were starting.
Yeah. Okay.
And he stood on the sand of the sea.
Okay. So yeah. So I was thinking. I can't remember exactly where. Because I read this a lot. So kind of keep my mental picture ready for us in class. Okay, any thoughts about this this beast rising out of the sea that the dragon basically empowers with all of its authority?
Is this sort of where the idea of the Antichrist comes from?
Well, the, actually, the phrase Antichrist comes from John. Okay. It's where the Antichrist is already there when he writes.
When I'm looking at the rest of the chapter, it looks like it's describing what the beast looks like, and then it says one of its heads appeared as though slaughtered to death, and its fatal wound had been healed, and the whole earth was astonished and followed after the beast. Mm-hmm. So it's like it had died, it had come back, and they worshipped the dragon because he had given authority to the beast, and they worshipped the beast, saying, who is like the beast and who is able to make war with him. So it's kind of, it seems like
the Christ story, the idea that Rome is kind of the Antichrist, I think, you know, certainly fits, but John uses it.
Do you technology? Do we call Forrest? What do we do? No, I call Forrest. I cry and call Forrest.
For some reason, it decided to stop casting.
Do you like how I'm always like,
no, it's
casting questionably.
No, yeah, now it's casting badly.
Friend?
Yeah. So it doesn't actually cast incredibly well.
No, maybe.
Is that King on the
first? Yep, there we go.
And we're back.
Rome can, I think, easily be seen, especially all of it and many of its leaders, as really, you know, kind of an Antichrist. But as John writes, the spirit of the Antichrist is already in the world, so the spirit of the Antichrist isn't just in the warriors who fight. It's also in the philosophies they use to fight. And so the Antichrist, which also is talks about the
First John.
Yeah,
it also makes a reference to it in Second John as well, but mostly First John.
Yeah, and then but you also have the man of sin who will be revealed. And then his name is getting off the top of my head. So the term Antichrist isn't really used in Revelation. People sometimes think of it when it, you know, in relation
to that.
I feel
like they're often sort of put together.
Yes.
It seems.
Yeah. But because you have this beast who's fighting Christ and his followers, and it's fighting with the authority of the devil. Yeah, I mean, it sounds very Antichrist. But I think the mistake is often made that there is a singular Antichrist.
Yeah, whereas comparatively, especially when you just said that, the Antichrist is present in philosophies as well as,
it's not really a person.
It's more
individual,
personified idea.
But, yeah, and John too. I mean, it basically says
in 1 John 2.
Sorry, 1 John 2. Verse 22, mm-hmm. Who is a liar but he who denies that Jesus is the Christ? This is the Antichrist. It's someone who denies Christ.
Somewhere in that passage, I think it says, and the spirit of the Antichrist is already, you know, at work in the world.
Is it Catholicism that's kind of embodied it generally as an individual to be kind of on the lookout for? Is it
Catholicism
that's kind of done that? Or?
My Catholic comes
I don't think so.
It's a concept of anything going against Christ.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be.
I feel like it's personified as a person and a lot of other.
The reformer, we're going to get here in a little bit. Because we're going to get to the religious nature of this Antichrist, this specific one. Yes. Yeah, so this beast is going to end up having a religious nature to it. Okay. We haven't gotten there yet. And Reformation, post-Catholicism, they really looked at Revelation as the popes being these antichrists, which again, I don't think it's an accurate view of Revelation. But it's what people do with Revelation. Anytime they see opposition, anything they see as opposition to trying to do good or godliness. I think people see in Revelation symbols that fit. Whenever you think, oh, they're fighting God, they're fighting, you know, good, then I think we see symbols in Revelation that make it go, oh, okay, that must be what it's talking about. That's why I think it fits all the time. It's why I think it fits the destruction of Jerusalem, why it fits the destruction of Rome, why it fits the destruction, you know, from reformers' concept, you know, it's like we're going to destroy the Catholic Church because they're the great beast, and why it fits modern people thinking, oh, okay, this is going to happen, and pretty soon these horses with tails that you know sting like a scorpion, well, you know that's going to be, you know, whatever the tanks. Helicopters are, the, you know, stinger missiles that they shoot out. It's like, oh, it'll be a stinger. Why does it fit all of that? Because the concept of people opposing goodness and godliness is very old. And it's happened all through the Old Testament. Lots of nations did it. Lots of nations fought with God. Lots of nations lost when God ultimately destroyed them. And it's just the way of the world. This is how people go. And so even though I think this is written, it's written at a time that I think is written to Christians to help them understand, yeah, it's going to look bad for you for a while, but don't worry. God will avenge you. And he will, as we've seen early in the Revelation, right? God protected them. So even those who die, what happens to them? I'm going to give them robes of light. I'm going to take care of them. I'm going to rest here a while till I finish what I'm doing. God is taking care of them in spite of the enemy coming after them.
So. Do you think the mortally wounded head is a specific?
Do I think what?
The mortally wounded head that is healed is a specific individual, or is it just in reference
empire? If it's an individual. This goes back to, I think I alluded to it very early, and I talked about some of the background. There is what is called the Nero. There was a myth in the first century that Nero was going to be resurrected. That Nero died and was going to be resurrected. This isn't just a Christian thing. This is actually in Roman Nero's resurrection myth that he was coming back. And he was going to, in fact, I have a cabinet in my, let me see if I didn't have any of my stuff. If it's an individual that's being referred to here, that would be my guess that it's being referred to, that this head who seems to go away and is dead and then comes back, that it might be, and so this is a fairly common thought, that the church and things and were pretty familiar with this myth as well. Nero Vitidism, I believe. Let's see if I have question. Actually, Nero Vitidivus. Anyway, I'll read a little bit of this, I guess. So I do have in some of the handouts I had given on page 5 of this section. It's a freedman, two old nurses, and his cast-off concubine, Acte, cared affectionately for Nero's remains, and for a long time, flowers were strewn on his grave. Soon the strange belief arose that Nero had not really died, but was living somewhere in retirement, perhaps in Parthia, and would return shortly to bring great calamity upon his enemies or the world. Some Jews amalgamated this belief with their concept of the Antichrist. Ascension of Isaiah 4, 1st century AD, clearly identifies the Antichrist with Nero. The idea repeatedly occurs in both Jewish and Christian sections of the Sibylline oracles. Now, how far the Christians regarded Nero as the historical personage our personage of the Antichrist is disputed. It would be natural if they had been influenced by contemporary thought about the revival of Nero. Particular guy wrote, regarded the beast of Revelation 13 as Rome and the smitten head whose mortal wound was healed as Nero. Some scholars think that Revelation 17 refers to Nero. Such passages in Revelation may refer to the spirit of Nero, but certainly not to Nero himself. Some scholars have applied the number 666 in 13:8 to Nero, but it suits others as well. So I don't know if it's very important that we say it is a specific person. If it is a specific person that they would have understood, Nero is probably the best idea. And especially as I think that this book is written in the 90s, this idea that, hey, he might be coming back. Nero was a brutal, horrific ruler. I mean, Rome had many, but a lot of them weren't as bad as somebody might think. They weren't all as maniacally...
outwardly malicious?
Yes, and vicious and cruel and just doing horrific things to people. Not all of them did that. Some of them, kind of believed in kind of the Stoicism philosophies of a lot of Romans. So that's kind of my, I don't really anymore try to figure out the individuals here behind this. That's kind of my long answer for that question.
Well, in the Lexham Edition Bible, it says for verse 3, and one of its heads appeared as though slaughtered to death. And I don't know if it compares to any of the other editions if the word appears.
In which verse?
Verse 3, chapter 13, verse 3. So this says
one of its heads seemed to have a mortal wound.
So it's like it appeared. So my initial thought before we were contemplating Nero was like, this is another trick. This is another which of course it is, but it's just like, oh, look at them back out to their old tricks. And then when it said appeared and you were reading what you were just reading, I was like, well,
maybe it wasn't actually.
Yeah.
Could be both.
So its mortal wound was healed, and so it's like, oh, it's back. And then it talks about the whole earth marvels that they followed the beast and they worshiped the dragon. This is kind of an interesting thing, one that I also think fits under Domitian. So really, we often think of the emperors of Rome thinking of themselves as gods, but that's a later thing. The early emperors did not see themselves as gods. Now, after they died, they often might be venerated as a god. But that concept that they thought they were gods to be worshipped is later and really, really heavy under Domitian. Domitian is the one who begins to require it. You have got to sacrifice an offer to me because I am essentially your god. So Domitian, that really kind of takes up. And they don't all do it, by the way. I mean, this is not an empire that had a single family rule. Typically, any emperor was going to be killed, and probably a lot of his family killed, because that's actually how they transitioned power, mostly in Rome. And so they were not all of the same, cut from that same wickedness. And it wasn't always accepted amongst the empire itself. I mean, forget the Christians. Sometimes the Romans themselves despised. And not just average Roman, but even the army, and especially the Praetorian Guard, who are kind of they're suspected as having killed a whole bunch of emperors. A whole bunch, probably the wrong word. A number of emperors are suspected of having died at the hands of their guards, who are like, this guy's got to go. He's too awful. They did come and go, as far as what they were like. And so sometimes we tend to lump it all, which I think is also why the persecution of Christians also came and went. It was not steady. from the end of the 90s, or from like roughly 90s, is when the persecution of Christians really began to be broader than just the Roman one under Nero was really localized, and it happened for a short period of time. Seems like he just wants to blame them for, you know, so he burned some stuff down so he can rebuild stuff in his own name. But under Domitian and forward, there are times, and there especially are locations in the Roman Empire where persecution of Christians kind of has a revival. It grows and it gets really strong for a while, and then it kind of dissipates and goes away, and then kind of comes back and goes. And so it waxes and wanes regularly until the 302, I think, is about when one of the worst actually happens in the early 300s, and then so it really gets, it's as bad as it probably ever was in the early 300s when Constantine has a dream that Jesus is leading him into battle and victory, and so he wakes up from his dream and puts the cross on his flags and goes into battle and wins a battle, and then that's essentially his conversion. Constantine actually wasn't baptized by the church for many, many years. In fact, close to his death, actually, if I remember accurately. But, hard part about this is all the history that goes into it, isn't it? So, okay. We're gonna stop there after this beast who has come. I do want to stop at verse 8, though. I don't know if I've read all of it there yet. And so, who's like the beast, who can fight it? In verse 4, the beast was given a mouth, utterly haughty and blasphemous words. It was allowed to exercise authority for 42 months. It opened its mouth to utter blasphemies against God, blaspheming his name and his dwelling, that is, those who dwell in heaven. Also, it was allowed to make war on the saints and to conquer them, and authority was given it over every tribe and people and language and nation, and all who dwell on earth will worship it. Everyone whose name has not been written before the foundation of the world in the book of life of the Lamb who was slain. And so everybody's going to worship the beast except those whose names are in the book of life. And if anyone has an ear to hear, let him hear. Now, let's end with this verse 10. If anyone is to be taken captive, to captivity he goes. If anyone is to be slain with the sword must he be slain. Here is a call for the endurance and the faith of the saints. What does that last couple verses tell us?
All believers need to stay steadfast.
Yeah.
This is happening now.
Yeah, even if you're gonna, if they're going to kill you, let it kill you.
Persecutions are going to be continual.
Exactly.
Yeah, as you were reading that, I just actually thought of your lesson today of how it's so much of this is out of our control, what happens with nations and in the world, and God's patience for exacting judgment on wicked people is not always on our time scale.
Right.
And so we just have to endure and trust in him and his, that judgment will happen.
Right.
But he's actually a very patient God.
Yes. He's often more patient than we would like when we want him to do something.
Right. Right.
Yes.
I like that. The line, which is used multiple times throughout the Bible, if anyone has an ear, let him hear. That concept is reaching out to people to be mindful and to look past the veil that the world sets in front of you, which is all of the distractions and temptations, and like you know, we're speaking in your lesson about things that seem okay,
right?
But if you look deep into them, they are slowly leading you off the path of truth and righteousness and into destruction.
Right.
But in the meantime, it seems short. It's just short-sighted. And so it's like that entertainment seems safe now, and then it's another one and another, and it just drags Christians away from truly focusing as we fill up our time with all the worldly distractions, we have less time available to continue to dig into Scripture and see the truth.
Yeah. And if you go to, if you become a captive, become a captive. I mean, none of us wants that, right? But that might happen. It's happened throughout history. In fact, one of the things I would be talking about in the near future sermon is, what do we do with all this? Boy, it's really bad. If we were being given this and right here, what would you think? Well, we probably shouldn't have kids. We probably shouldn't get married. I mean, it's like, this is too bad. This is too horrible. Well, how bad do you think it was for all those Jews who were taken away to Babylon? Those handful of thousands who were also being told by the prophets that 90% or 95% of their brethren were all going to be killed in Jerusalem. And, you know, they're being taken to be a slave to Babylon. And yet, Jeremiah has to write them a letter and tell them, just keep living. You just keep going. That's our response to it. That's our theme of this year. You just keep pressing on. You keep doing all the godly stuff God said is good to do. Keep doing. That's all we can do. We don't have power and control and wisdom about what's happening, but we need to just keep living. We need to keep working. We need to keep producing. We need to keep, you know, growing. You know, and yet I think a lot of Christianity has fallen into this, like, wow, things are too bad. I think we've fallen into the exact same thing that a lot of the world is. Oh, the world's so bad, everything's so bad, you know, we need to not, you know, it isn't good to have as many kids as we have, and, like, you know, we need to abort more of them. These concepts are just not what God ever recommended, even in the worst of situations. All we can keep doing. And our job isn't to pick up arms and fight the wickedness of the world, is it? We might pick up arms to defend our family or our nation or our country, but it's not. In doing that, all we're doing is just, you know, trying to be good citizens in whatever country we're in. But we're not going to defeat evil. God does that. Our job is just to keep living righteously and deal with it, overcome it, so, and overcome it like this, with acceptance. That's actually, it's kind of scary, though, isn't it, to be told that?
Well, yeah. Also with voting, though, we do need to make our voice heard, yeah. Even if we're not picking up physical arms, right. We need to be educated and vote, because sure. We do influence through our purchases, through our legislators, through who we elect. Sure. So Christians need to be involved with that. And verse 8 tells us the most important thing we need to do is make sure our name is written in the Lamb's Book of Life. Because if it is not written in that book, it doesn't matter how many godly works you do.
Yeah.
In the end, you're not in the book.
Right.
So Jesus will say, go depart from me, I never knew you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, we should use our ability to influence our culture, our communities, for good. Whatever opportunities we have. But if we ended up in a country that we had no voting, had no vote,
right.
We keep doing the same thing.
Yep.
It doesn't change. You use whatever opportunities you have, whatever things you have, you do that. And try to influence yourself first, because we have to fight it in our own minds, all the wickedness coming at us. And then, obviously, try to help others too. So, we'll pick up at the second beast in chapter 13 next week. So I appreciate everybody. Went a few minutes long, but hard to get through Revelation quickly. Let's have a prayer. Our dear Heavenly Father, we thank you so much for this day. We thank you for our ability to come together in peace, to be able to read and study the vision you gave John, to help us understand that you are in control, and that whatever comes, good or bad, to always remember that, and to simply be your people who act out of love and compassion and kindness and goodness and love in truth. Help us to love the truth, help us to be caring and compassionate, and help us to have wisdom to know what you would want us to know from the vision you've given to John. And give us wisdom as we think on these things and meditate on them. And so we thank you for this day and thank you for the word and especially thankful for Christ. In his name we pray. Amen. Okay. Well, thank you, everybody. Hopefully that was a decent overview.
Had time.
For you.
No, you're coming over
there. Supervising.
No.
We'll show me what to do.
Time. And then you're like, hey, have your own calls.
I got 10.
I like how we're